First, I want to discuss some of the many so-called alternative cancer therapies and see whether they are acceptable as alternatives. An alternative that serves the same philosophy as conventional cancer therapy, that is solely the destruction of cancer cells, is not what FACT considers an alternative. The only alternatives we consider supportable are those which are biologically sound, therefore non-toxic, and do no harm. I want to talk about hydrazine sulfate, which many of you may have heard about if you've entered the health movement, vitamin A Mulsin, and selenium especially. Hydrazine sulfate, we cannot, although it is an alternative to conventional therapy, we don't consider it a biological alternative. Therefore, it is not supported by the FACT organization. Hydrazine sulfate is a chemical. It is used to produce rocket fuel. Its function is to block the liver from converting lactic acid into glucose and in this way starve the cancer cell. It also, unfortunately, starves the healthy cell too, since it in no way can be selective. Cells need glucose. Glucose provides us with energy. In medical circles, in order to rid the body of cancer cells, they don't take into account the destruction it's doing to the patient. Now, you'll find the theme all through our convention and in any discussion with any of the people here or any of the books, it will always be to preserve the integrity of the patient and not concentrate so much on the tumor itself, although there are techniques that can be used as anti-tumor techniques, but they need to be systems that don't hurt the patient. Another controversy, vitamin A Mulsin is the next one. You talk to any doctor, even those committed to nutrition for better health, and there will be agreement that high doses of vitamin A are toxic. Vitamin A Mulsin is, first of all, not a vitamin, but a chemical, which it is claimed works like vitamin A. It is given by drops, which easily can be from 500,000 to 1,000,000 units. The claim of efficacy is that it enters the bloodstream by bypassing the liver. It does bypass the liver, but it then stores in the liver. There is no question about its toxicity to the liver either. Mr. Ransberger, who heads the Wobbemugos Company, if you were here earlier, you heard us talk about the Wobbemugos Company. They are the producers of A. Mulsin. They also produce those Wobbemugos enzymes, which Mr. Carter was talking about. But here we're talking about an entirely different product. And there, too, I would like to warn you not to assume that if a company produces one product that is excellent, you can therefore apply that yardstick to all of their production. You have to be selective at all times. Now, Mr. Ransberger came to see me back in New York when some research was going on at Sloan Kettering. The lateral research was going on at Sloan Kettering. And we were very much involved in serving as a bridge between the alternative therapies and the establishment in doing that research. They had also gotten to know about some of the people who were participating in some of the products and services that were available to the alternative cancer area. And we talked about Wobbemugos, we talked about the A-Molson, which he knew I took exception to, and that we had seen cause a great deal of harm, unfortunately. I mentioned some of the case histories of patients which we saw fail. And what he said to me, which very few doctors here in the United States are paying much attention to, was that it is never used in Europe on liver cancer and should not be used on liver cancer. But we take exception to its use for any kind of cancer because it is not a biologically sound material. Its physiology then is not biologically sound. Another substance which has gotten a lot of play, which the Foundation for Alternative Cancer Therapies doesn't support, is selenium. There's a doctor up in New York who uses it in his practice to reduce tumors, but in no way will he use a dietary program to go along with the selenium, because he's using it to some extent to create acid or alkaline balance. He uses selenium in order to create the acidity. He uses, it's sulfur that they use usually in the south at the end of the winter in order to purge the system. I forget what it's called, but it's a sulfur product. And he would create the acid or alkaline balance with these two products. Now, if we attempted to put a patient on a good dietary program, you'll hear from Mr. Rasmussen, and you did hear from Dr. Ali yesterday, when he spoke about the type of food, that type of food creates more alkalinity in the system than acidity. It would interfere with what he's doing. But we also must take another factor into account, and that is this. Although selenium is a trace mineral, and that our bodies do have trace minerals and must have trace minerals, including selenium, and there are others, some of these, or most of them, are toxic in doses higher than the body can use. So again, we're using a substance which is practically a poison. Not as toxic, of course, as some things that are pure poison, but it is toxic to the system. Again, if it's a toxic substance, it puts a tremendous load on the body to eliminate it as a waste material. And in cancer patients where they don't have that capacity, they don't have that competent ability to eliminate all their waste products, it then has a tendency to be cumulative, and instead of being helpful, it is harmful, and you can't achieve a biological repair with substances of that kind. I don't mean to stand here to be critical of anybody who's doing cancer therapy of any kind. That is not my role. We don't even tell you not to take chemotherapy. What we're saying is we don't support that kind of system, that it will not work well if you're interested in a good biological alternative. But the biological alternative has the capacity to make a repair to the system. It has the capacity to give the body the material it requires to start building healthy cells and to discontinue the production of unhealthy cells. And we think that that's the important way to take care of a cancer problem. And even if one is taking radiation or chemotherapy or has had surgery, we still think they ought to take the dietary program. And it is not, again, and I must emphasize this, if any of you came to me and said, should I take the chemotherapy, I would say that's a decision you must make yourself. You discuss it with your doctor. We might send you to a medical library, and we think it's wiser for you to go to a medical library. Look up chemotherapy instead of just simply accepting the fact that the doctor has offered you chemotherapy. Take into account, too, that the doctor is practically compelled to offer you chemotherapy. And I say practically. I had to modify that because there is a set of protocols for patients, And if they don't offer the patient that protocol, and you go to another doctor who gives you supposedly the correct protocol, you can turn around and sue the first doctor and say, you didn't do the right thing for me. So he's practicing defensive medicine. If you know what you're doing, knowing what he's doing, give him some consideration too, because they're carrying enormously high insurance and they're also dealing with people who are terribly unschooled and unpredictable for them. So when the doctor offers you a medication, take the time to either look it up where, if you can, in the physician's desk reference, or go to your medical library. They're all usually open to the public so that you can look up any of this material, and it's not difficult. So you decide about the drug before you take it, and that way you are participating with the doctor. We are saying to the doctor too that this is a system that is in their interest. It takes the burden of responsibility from them. It is shared with the patient. And I think patients should assume responsibility. That's a kind of independence. We must break away from the system where we're looking for the mother or father to take us by the hand and do everything for us. We're capable of thinking for ourselves, and I think the doctor ought to give us that consideration and allow us to think for themselves. I don't know whether you know it, but I lost my daughter to leukemia. And I was as naive as anyone else could possibly be. I read the same material, the same glowing reports about the treatment and the progress that it was making, and the reality turned out to be terribly different. I was told there was an 85% remission rate. It sounded to me as though I was hearing an 85% cure rate. So all of these terms mean something. I didn't go to the medical library to look up what the drugs were. I was told by two doctors that they were working a new system. This was an advanced kind of program that she was on. There were two teams that had been designated to work out these programs and to keep records. They were hematologists in the program. And she was a member of that program. And I thought, well, heavens, we've made tremendous advances, and aren't we lucky that she's able to participate in this? But actually what it was, they had two teams, and we naively didn't understand it. One team had a set of protocols for leukemia. The other team had another set of protocols for leukemia. And they were going to use these protocols, and somewhere far down the line, they would then evaluate what they had done. It's the way it is done. I don't even say it with anger. What I am concerned about is the lack of knowledge that the average layperson has. There's been a lot of talk about Ronald Reagan and the colon cancer. And we hear someone say, oh, I bet they're not giving him chemotherapy because they won't do that to him. That's not the fact at all. The truth of the matter is that they did a study recently covering a 5-year period with colon cancer patients. And the final conclusion was that the patients who had no treatment after surgery did better than those patients who had chemotherapy after surgery. Well, they're wise enough to know that, and so why should they offer it to Ronald Reagan? They're doing what they have learned to do. So I say again, if your doctor offers you a treatment for colon cancer, anything else, go to your medical library. Be a participant with him. Take on the responsibility. You may be taking on the responsibility of saving your life. Here again, we're asked many times, what are your programs? Are they megavitamin therapy? They're not megavitamin therapy. They're not even vitamin therapy. They are biological systems. It does include nutrition. It includes detoxification. But it also takes into account total body chemistry. Dr. Hamilton was here you saw her presentation and heard the reason for the presentation, that it was to see that there was good function of the body, that there was no blockage in the signals going out to the various organs. We have organs that depend upon those signals. They're that, especially the autonomic nerve system. Well, I phrased that a little differently. Let me straighten up. You've got organs that are attached to the autonomic nerve system, which means they work spontaneously. You don't decide to have them work. They work spontaneously. Your heart is a muscle. It works spontaneously. All of the endocrine system works spontaneously. It's quite possible, we feel, that it is triggered by the food you put into your mouth. It gives the signal to the various organs to produce certain digestive juices to signal to the next organ what its step is going to be. The body has been arranged beautifully. We have no respect for it, or at least not enough respect for it. So we don't use vitamin therapy. It is a biologically sound system, and the doctor who is handling the patient must take into account any impairment in the function of that body, whether it's the joint here in front of the ear, which is playing havoc with the spinal column, or whether there might be an organ or two which isn't secreting all of its digestive juices, whether the patient is too tense, and this is causing an interference in the absorption, the utilization of any of the vitamins and minerals and enzymes. So without going too deeply into some of these things, because I could probably spend a great deal of time on one area alone, but I want to get finished here and let us go home. Now, anyone who just simply gives a patient megavitamins without first determining whether your body chemistry requires those supplements, and we don't even like to call what is used in one of these biologically sound programs, we don't even like to call them vitamins. We prefer to call them food supplements. That means they are very carefully handled, they're very carefully processed, they are equivalent to taking food. There are many vitamins that people are taking that are produced by manufacturers, especially with the growth of the, I don't want to say the health industry because that's what's growing, but with the growth of the population looking for better health and becoming more knowledgeable, you also have, unfortunately, people who have been in the production of some materials, pharmaceuticals, and things of other kind. They're also producing vitamin supplements, but their standard is somewhat different. They produce synthetics. They produce fragmented material. They put color coding on some of them because they want them to be able to see the differences. Sometimes it's sugar. We don't like the enteric coating for the cancer patient. It's supposed to go down into the system and reach its site without being dissolved too early. But the fact is the enteric coating is a protein coating, and most cancer patients need help in digesting protein. So sometimes instead of it going down to the site where it belongs, it goes right through the system and comes out into your toilet without being used at all. And that's an expensive thing to do. So you select your supplements with great care, and the doctor who is not using the so-called megavitamin therapy will select the supplements for the patient based on his individual need. This is why when someone kept asking Walter Carter what his program was, either he evaded, or it wasn't an evasion, he just didn't have the answer, or I kind of skirted it another way trying to tell the patient his program is not your program. If you heard Hy Raden yesterday, he said repeatedly, this was for me. It doesn't mean it's for you. Your body chemistry is different. Any program that you have should be applicable to your body chemistry and your particular needs. Now, You'll run into people who will say, well, that lady told me, or I stood next to someone here at the convention and someone suggested I do that because she's a cancer patient, and everything turned into, well, to me, spontaneously, I was going to say fantasy, but you know that this was the most marvelous thing to do. The magic wand was waved and you turn into the Cinderella. What can happen is, if a person is vitamin deficient, and some doctor who's in vitamin therapy gives them the whole battery of vitamins, they come away in a short period of time saying, hey, I feel great. This is marvelous, because it's feeding a desperate vitamin deficiency. But what happens when it has reached its saturation? Now we're dealing with the same substances as excesses. Body chemistry can be imbalanced with excesses as well as deficiencies. I don't know whether I'm right or not, but I'm taking an educated guess, and you can believe that it's an educated guess because I've been around here for a long period of time, that the body can repair from deficiencies a lot more quickly, very quickly as a matter of fact, than it can from excesses. It has the burden on a daily basis of excreting the waste products from the food we eat. That's about as much as it can handle as a rule. And then it has to take on the extra burden of excreting the materials that were excessive, going in on an excessive level, and when it can't do that, then it becomes cumulative. And when things are cumulative, you're running into hazards. We feel, too, that it is at the point where these materials of whatever kind they are, and I don't want to specify just the vitamins, but they may be drugs, they may be pollution in your food supply, because the Food and Drug Administration allows so much poisoning of the food supply, pollution of your water supply, and after a while we feel that the body gets so loaded with some of these things, it manifests disease. Now, the disease doesn't necessarily have to be cancer, but it certainly can be. And if we take into account that the cancer incidence is now 1 out of 3 officially, has changed from 1 out of 4 now to 1 out of 3 officially, it's not hard to assume that possibly something's going on out there, pollution of our food, water, and air, that is creating this situation. Even though there's an admission of 1 out of 3, there is also evidence that there are people who enter the hospital for other diseases which they die of, and in many instances autopsies are performed and it is discovered that that was a cancer patient too. Now that's not a statistic. It isn't handled as a statistic to add on to the 1 out of 3 because the patient died of something else. I'm unable to time myself, so Fleming, would you do it for me?
What do you want?
Where are you? We're 20 after 4. I want to allow time for some questions, but there are two more things, and I'm going to try to cover them very quickly because they're so important. The first one is exercise. The more important one I'm going to leave for last. The idea of jogging has become very popular, or aerobics has become very popular. Exercise is marvelous for the body. You breathe better, your muscle tone is good, internal muscle tone is good. We mustn't always think of muscles as the ones you see on the outside, but you have to take into account the internal muscle tone, which osteopathy does take into account. But exercise that exhausts is taking good vitality and wasting it. Vitality should be used for healing, for maintaining health, and not wasted unnecessarily. The idea of jogging and aerobics actually came from the idea of weight reduction. We can reduce our weight with a proper diet, but not necessarily having to wear it off in that really horrendous fashion, as far as I'm concerned. We also have new information, and I've got to get some of these things are printed in medical magazines or other magazines, and we don't like to present them until we've gone to the medical establishment or the medical library to get the originals and to read the full report. But I'm going to tell you this because, and give it to you in as simple terms as I know how. A group of men doing research, two on a team and two others on a team, determined that the exhausting type of exercise actually causes the body to secrete some materials which have a negative effect on the organism. So let's continue to exercise, walking, swimming. There are so many things one can do that is not necessarily exhausting without, you know, beginning to be a sedentary individual. Now, the last one, of course, is, as I say, I think, one of our most important things to talk about, and that's elimination of our waste products. We very recently had someone go to a medical library and collect some data for us on Sir William Arbuthnot Lane. We published his book a number of years ago. It's called something, The Diseases of Civilization. It was an out-of-print book which Corinne Loretta, one of our trustees, happened to pick up in a used bookstore for a dollar. She knew what the book was about, and we were delighted to be able to get the book. We followed through and wrote to the publishers, and they said they're not interested in it anymore, and so FACT decided to publish the book itself. But I must give you some background on William Arbuthnot Lane so that you'll know why we were interested in his work. He was a surgeon at one of the best institutions in London. His father and his grandfather were both doctors, and he was dedicated to his profession. He developed his skill to a point where he was presenting his work to other doctors, and then he was invited to the United States from England, and it wasn't just flying by plane and getting here very quickly, or using the Concorde to get here. And he'd come to the United States and came here more than once when he'd show his procedures in the operating room of a hospital. The gallery was filled with doctors coming from all over. He showed his techniques in Europe and in the United States and in England, and these techniques were adopted. He was given many awards, and he was actually knighted by the royal family. This is where he became Sir William Arbuthnot Lane, MD. When he was about 60, he did some colon surgery for a young man who had rheumatoid arthritis. There was an inflammation in the colon, and as a surgeon, he decided to remove that inflammation. But there was an unusual result. The patient, who had been confined to a wheelchair, got better and began to walk, and he had cured this chronic degenerative disease by removing an inflamed part of the colon. We knew that story, and we wanted to get the rest of the information of Sir William Arbuthnot Lane. And I was very fortunate just this last year to have a woman who was accustomed to doing research in a medical library and had a library card from a doctor so that she could go into the hospital and actually borrow the books, and brought them to me, and we went through them. And we found that Dr. Lane, during those last 20, he died when he was about 81 in the 1940-41. And what he did was try to convince his colleagues of the importance of taking care of the colon. He talked about cleaning the colon through whatever means one would do it. That's where they drew the line, and the opposition began to arise. We think his work is going to be resurrected, and that people are going to understand better and appreciate what he was trying to do. At a subsequent point, instead of doing colon surgery, now this was a surgeon who took this position about his own work. As I say, he was a dedicated doctor first of all. He thought to himself, why do we have to do surgery? And he had even been teaching the technique to other doctors who did agree with him and believed in what he was doing. He decided, let's clean out the colon. And what he proposed at that time was that they use paraffin oil for colon cleansing. It was only recently that I had someone else doing some work for me, and she discovered that the paraffin oil was British kerosene. And this is what he proposed to use to accomplish colon cleansing. He never did get agreement before he died from his colleagues. He did say to a group of colleagues where he lectured one time, he said, I will never die of cancer. And what I have done for myself and am doing for myself, you too can do. And then he went on to give this full report of what he believed in, that the colon needed to be kept clean. If we wash our face and hands, there is no reason to assume that that colon should be left with garbage in it that might be 3 and 4 days old. Every one of the doctors to whom we refer patients and who have been doing work over 100 years now, we've collected and investigated a lot of the work done by so-called natural healers, although they're labeled natural healers, many of them were MDs. They all included colon cleansing in their work. They all talked about blood pollution or blood sludge. So here's where we feel that you ought to recognize a difference. And that is that when the doctors say it may be normal for you to move your bowels every 3 weeks or every 2 weeks or once a week, the assumption should be that if you eat 3 times a day, there's waste from your meal in the colon 3 times a day. If your colon is very healthy, and the muscle tone is normal, as it should be, it will carry that bolus to the point of elimination 3 times a day. It's hard to expect movements 3 times a day, but at least one should empty that bowel of that waste material once a day. If you move your bowels once a day, but there you have 4 days transit time, that's constipation. It means that the meal going in here is pushing the waste of a meal that went into the bowel 4 days ago, which means it's taking 4 days to go through to that point. That's 4 days transit time. Even though that happens daily, you know, one meal pushes the other, and you do it daily, that's still a form of constipation. I'm trying. What time do we have?
4:30.
All right. One more thing. You may have noticed that we invite distributors here or exhibitors here with great care. We could have the room filled and overflowing into this room and into the lobby with exhibitors. But we try to be very careful and invite exhibitors who are giving you something that we feel is appropriate and not anything else. You'll find we've invited someone with the Pure Water Society with a distiller. We invited someone with the reverse osmosis two ways to purify your water. We get too many calls from people who say, I'm using spring water, and they think now they've got pure water. Well, we don't think so. And of course, the other argument is, it's devoid of minerals. Well, so what? Suppose, now I don't mean spring water, but your distilled water is devoid of minerals. Well, those minerals aren't the healthiest minerals anyway. If you're eating properly, which you should be doing, you will be getting the best quality minerals you can get out of your raw food. If you put it in water and the water leaches the minerals out and you throw that down the drain, it's too bad the drain can't get some benefit out of it. But you're not getting benefit from it either. But that's where your minerals should come from. The minerals in the water are not organic. They don't become organic until the plant absorbs it and turns it into organic material. So that we would say, if you're looking for pure water, unfortunately, at this time, it is wiser to use either distillation or the reverse osmosis. Now, let me tell you what can be wrong with your spring water. If you didn't hear me say it yesterday, I'd like to repeat it again today. Most of the spring water comes from underground rivers. They're called aquifers. They can be much more polluted than the water coming out of your tap, because the chemicals that are used on the ground, spewed out from plants, seeps right down into those aquifers, and many of these toxic chemicals settle in little valleys that they have there in the water table, and it may at one time sit there, and then it rains, it changes its position, and you get it in your spring water. It is better to use distilled water. And as I say, I'm not so sure whether your spring water is better than your tap water. I think I've covered all my ground. And if you'll keep track of the time, 4:30? All right, we'll see. All right, we'll take 5 minutes, and then it's all right if we go a little beyond 5:30. Any questions? And if you do have them, will you use the mic? Would you take you go on to the side and use the mic? They need it for the taping. They're testing to see if it's on. It's on? Okay. Talk into it.
Hello?
Oh, wait a minute. Give it to me.
Hello?
Support Laetril.
Do I support Laetril? Not at the present time. We did years ago. It was manufactured differently. We feel it is over-refined today and therefore is not producing the results that we had seen then. That's the only reason we don't support it, is we're not seeing the results that we did see then.
When you were speaking about food supplements, you mentioned that if we took an excessive amount, that that would be waste settling in the body. How can we know when we are taking excessive amounts? And I have another question. With food supplements, since organic matter is more beneficial than inorganic, many of the food supplements are made from synthetic materials, which you mentioned. And are they bad?
Not the food supplements that I'm talking about. The material that is called food supplements, they are not made from synthetic material. The vitamins can be made from synthetic material. The only thing you can do is try to have your doctor determine whether you have a deficiency or not. I'll tell you what High Radin did in going through material and reading a good deal of material. Actually, it was Adele Davis's book, which we feel is a risky kind of thing to use because it promotes the use of supplements. And I don't want to be critical of her because I think there were some people who were instrumental in bringing a lot of people into health thinking, and they must be credited for doing that. But he read Adele Davis's book, and then he said, "That symptom is mine. That symptom is mine," do you see? And so he took the things that he felt, the supplements that were associated with the symptom, and it turned out to be fairly good. He did tell you that he subsequently did find a doctor who took care of his program and his supplementation. There's also a test which is done by a Dr. Bailey. He's not doing the test anymore. It's being done at a laboratory now. His name is Dr. Herman Baker, and it's in the New Jersey laboratory where they can take a test which will give you the determinations of about 12 different supplements routinely. If you want more, they can add them on and you pay accordingly.
I see. But therefore, you are not speaking of vitamins, so-called, as the food supplements that
you
were speaking about.
No, I made it a point to differentiate between the two. I think we need a term that differentiates between the two.
You've never done this before. How could you do this to me now? You left me with a cliffhanger. You started to talk about the kerosene therapy, and then, bang, it was ended.
Well, because I was talking about Sir William Arbuthnot Lane. If you want me to give you a quick idea of where we're at with the... this lady must be familiar with the fact that we printed information about kerosene in one of our magazines. We had gotten the information from someone, and we decided that the only way to pick up further data on it, because all of the people mentioned in the article were no longer around. The doctor that was mentioned was no longer around. So we printed the material in our magazine with an introductory paragraph which said, we don't know enough about this. We're not offering it as a therapy. We're looking for the information too. And if anyone is going to use it or has information, please get in touch with us. Well, we were very much surprised with the amount of information that we got and the quality of the information that people in Europe, Germany, Poland, Switzerland, and in South Africa, they were used to taking kerosene. And they did it sometimes in a fairly routine fashion. Now that surprised us to begin with. Then we found that some daughter and son or little family, their mother and father, whenever they got sick with a fever or a cold of any kind, the first thing they did was give them kerosene. Now we began to see things differently. Then I got a call from a lady who was born in Germany. She was 80 years old, so she was a youngster in Germany quite a long time ago, and she said, "I'd like to get the kerosene." And I said, "We're not offering it to you. We don't have enough information to say this is fine for the cancer patient." She said, "It's all right. I want to use it." I said, "Well, I'm not going to withhold the information that I have up to now if that's what you want, but you're taking on the responsibility." And so she said, "Fine, that's what I am going to do." So we told her where to get in touch with Paula Ganner. This was her work. She had developed it through her own case history. And they contacted her daughter, with the help of her daughter, they contacted Paula Ganner and did get some of the kerosene and used it. And there, too, they reported to us all the time what the reactions were. And we were not unhappy with those reactions. Now, only recently, and the very person who did the work of the research is the daughter of the woman who took the kerosene. She was the one who discovered for me that the paraffin oil that Dr. Lane had been proposing for to keep the colon healthy and clean was called British kerosene. Now, that's as much as I have for you. And any time we collect additional data which we feel we have enough of the information, We'll print it. Matter of fact, I've been toying with the idea, and right now it's just an idea, that maybe we ought to take the information to the National Cancer Institute, even up to the point that we are now, and see if they want to follow through on it, which would be the best thing all around if they do the research and give us the data. What?
Okay.
They might. One has to offer it and not complain that they're not doing it if you haven't offered them the opportunity. If they don't, we'll just say they don't want to.
Hi, I'm interested in how you feel the foundation feels about macrobiotic diet.
I'm sorry you asked that, but I'll answer it.
Okay, and also Emmanuel.
You see, I kind of
avoid Dr. Emmanuel Ravisi.
Actually, you have gotten a report about Dr. Emmanuel Ravisi because he's the one who's using the selenium as he is. All right?
Okay.
Now, on macrobiotics, I think what has made macrobiotics as popular as it is has been Dr. Satellaro's story. But I think it's also important to know that we know and have heard, and I'm sure I'm not wrong, that he's been using raw food with his so-called macrobiotics, which is then not considered macrobiotics. Now, our position about macrobiotics is this, and look at the differences here. Macrobiotics is all cooked food. Macrobiotics is high in grains, acid foods. The raw food diet, as I say, we've adopted the concepts of a whole school of thinking. It isn't just one type of thinking that is called macrobiotic, and what we're talking about comes from at least 100 years of work. It's not a very recent system. What is it? It's raw food, primarily alkaline. It does have grains in it, but they're not cooked to death. We like to have people eat their grains what we call thermos cooked, so that all the enzymes are still intact. If you cook your food, what you destroy are the enzymes. But the enzymes are the catalyst to help digest the very food that it's in. Now, that doesn't mean one should never eat cooked food, but those are the differences between macrobiotic. We feel in its natural state that raw food contains all of the elements that nature intended for the human system, just as it provides food for every animal on earth. The bird knows that his food will be insects, worms, seeds. There's food for us too, and it didn't come with a stove. So I think I've explained that.
I'd like to know, can you give a brief synopsis on what do you think with herbs, the use of herbs? Because I've been more or less reading Jethro Gloss's book, Back to Eden. And also I'd like to know two questions. What has happened with the congressional hearing that they have where they wanted to make all vitamins and herbs part of where you have to have some kind of subscription?
Oh,
thank you.
That was a long time ago, and that was fought down.
And it was. Do you have any information? Because I'm interested in doing back and getting the reading and what.
I don't think we've bothered with it for years, 10 years possibly.
Well, I belong to one of the.
This is
a new bill that's
Someone's going to help me understand. Susan, do you want to tell me? Tell us on the mic. All right, get the copy.
I belong to one of the nutritional programs that does market herbs, and they have recently discussed that you have to keep abreast with this, that the Congress passed another bill trying to do the same thing again.
Well, look, we fought down a bill many years ago where they wanted to put some controls on vitamins, and although I don't necessarily hold with the indiscriminate use of vitamins, I feel it's a choice that the patient has to make and the doctor has to have the freedom to make it, not necessarily with writing prescriptions so that you get it only from pharmaceutical houses. Just recently, Claude Pepper held hearings to try to put some restrictions on the health movement so that all nutrition was only presented by professional people. That is no longer a threat at the present time. He did not introduce the bill again in this 99th Congress, do you see? Now, I don't know about this bill, but we'll put up the same fight. It will be the same broad group of people to put up the fight. Now, if we want to talk about herbs, what I would like people to understand is some herbs are medicine. Some herbs can be used as herbal teas. And you need to distinguish between the two and not use the medicines as you would an herbal tea.
I'll try
to. But you've got good vitamins, good minerals, and the enzymes, if they're properly dried, intact in the herbs.
I believe what was referred to by this woman back here, there's a bill called Please Co-Sponsor H.R. 1819. The Foods Are Not Drugs Act. The Foods Are Not Drugs Act. The herb people in Utah were being discriminated and put into jail for the sale of herbs, and they initiated this bill.
Oh.
But the broad purpose of this bill is to prevent the Food and Drug Administration from putting health people or doctors or anyone into jail for recommending the use of vitamins or minerals or herbs. And that's what they have been doing, because these things have not been passed by the Food and Drug Administration specifically for a specific disease. So this is the main problem the health industry has had for the past 20 years. It cost about $20 million to $40 million to get FDA approval for anything. And no food has been an FDA approval.
Okay.
And that's what the purpose
Let's,
of the bill
yeah,
is.
I understand.
Available at the counter.
At the desk out there. I'm sorry to rush you, but Jack, it's only that Mr. Rasmussen is waiting for me to finish quickly, if possible.
What do you think about the, you said about the colon cleansing, what do you think about the colonics that are given with the water and the oxygen in?
Well, it doesn't have to have oxygen. I probably hold with the point of view of Dr. Walker, who's well over 100 years old. You know, he's about 116 or 17 years old. And he said the oxygen wasn't necessarily intended for the colon. But the colon cleansing of Dr. Walker's, I would certainly go along with. And all of the people we will refer to, all of the doctors we refer patients to, all agree, you've got to get that pollution out of the colon. You have to restore the muscle tone of the colon. In other words, that's part of your machinery, and that has to work well. Your heart works well, your lungs work well, your colon must work well. All right, I thank you for listening to me. Now.